definitely when I became like a teenager and went off to college, I totally did not eat any pork. I called it all slave food.
This is Nicole Taylor. She's the African-American author of The Up South Cookbook. She grew up in Athens, Georgia, lives in New York now.
I'm like, I'm not eating the old school neck bones and rice, stuff now that all these fancy chefs are doing in their restaurants. I just thought it was like, you know, it's poor people's food. I didn't have enough education about what that food meant for my mother and for my aunts and, you know, the whole entire community. This is the food that reminded them of when things were, you know, really happy.
And what changed?
I moved to New York City. That's when it that's when it all started. The longer I got in New York, the more I longed for home and the food of home.
Today on The Sporkful, our series Other People's Food continues. How does what we think about different people affect what we think about their food? When other people have stereotypes about our food, how does that change the way we feel about ourselves? And how does all this affect what we actually end up eating? We'll find out. Stick around. From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. This is part two of our series, Other People's Food. In part one, we talked about what happens when chefs make changes to cuisines that they weren't born into, and especially what happens when the cuisine is associated with people of color and the chef doing the changing is white. That's part one, up now. Today, we're going to focus on the ways that food and identity overlap, the ways that stereotypes of people affect perceptions of food, and how all that feeds back into how we feel about ourselves and the food that ends up on our plates. As I said, Nicole Taylor grew up in Athens, Georgia. Her Up South cookbook draws from her Southern upbringing, as well as her past 8 years spent living in Brooklyn. Her food isn't easily categorized. That's the way she likes it.
I do embrace the word authentic, and that means being your authentic self, but not authentic in terms of food. Everybody has their own thing of how they make a certain thing, like fried chicken. There are a million gazillion ways to do fried chicken. You know, I use coconut milk in my fried chicken.
Mm. Can we just like talk for a minute about fried chicken?
Oh, let's.
What is your relationship with fried chicken, Nicole?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I did not have fried chicken every day. I think a lot of people, I mean, when I moved to New York, this is a very, very funny story, Dan. I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and say, where can I find the best fried chicken?
No.
Yes. And I'm like, I guess they asked me that because I'm from the South. And I'm like,
Really? Nicole, you think that's the only reason?
Well, I mean, why? Because I'm a black woman.
Maybe.
So you want me to keep it real? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Why do they keep asking me where the best fried chicken? I'm like, ask all these other people in New York that have been here forever. I don't know. I've only been here a year or so. And so my clever response would be in my kitchen.
It is interesting that, like, it is this food that is kind of fraught in some ways and also so beloved. Like, have you ever been in a situation where you felt, like, self-conscious about eating fried chicken or loving fried chicken?
So, I mean, I grew up always knowing that when you're around white people and other folks don't eat fried chicken and watermelon. Sometimes, yeah, if I'm going out to a business dinner with someone else, I won't order the fried chicken because I'm like, they assume that I'm going to order that. So I'm like, oh, I'm just going to get the salad or the fish because there was a shame associated with those foods.
How many times would we have to go out to eat together before you'd have fried chicken with me?
A lot. A lot of times that I would have to curse and, like, get drunk and, before I feel comfortable eating the fried chicken.
What if I ordered fried chicken? That would make you feel more comfortable?
No. As a black American, a black woman from the South, you know, particularly when you're doing food stuff, you never want to get put into a box. And so you're constantly aware of kind of cultural foods and what, at least I am, and how they play into other people's psyche. I'm proud of fried chicken, but yeah, there are still things about my cultural foods that I'm aware other folks just, they still have those stereotypes. And I don't feel like explaining, so I would just rather order a salad, you know?
The truth is, those judgments about What foods are for what type of people? Which foods are for poor people? To use Nicole's words, we all do that in one way or another, even if we don't realize it.
Most Americans would hesitate to pay $30 for Chinese food, but they wouldn't bat an eyelid to pay hundreds of dollars. Sometimes over the last couple of years, the most expensive New York City restaurants have been Japanese restaurants.
This is Professor Krishnendu Ray, chair of the Food Studies Department at NYU. He says there's a reason why we're willing to pay so much more for some cultures' foods than others. And it's actually not about the food at all.
Most of the Japanese we are familiar with are business folks, are executives. But right now, most Americans associate Chinese food with relatively impoverished Chinese immigrants. If a group of people are doing well, and if a country is doing well economically, we tend to upgrade our estimation of their culture. And that feeds back into whether we consider it cheap ethnic food or we consider it expensive foreign food.
This idea that some foods are perceived as higher class than others, Professor Ray calls this the hierarchy of taste. He says over time, it changes.
Give it 20 more years, Chinese immigration is going to slow down, like it happened with European immigration. And once that happens, we don't meet relatively poor and impoverished Chinese here, our valuation of Chinese food is going to change in terms of class terms. That happened with Italian food. That Italian food, in fact, became prestigious only after Italian immigration effectively stopped of poor people.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, generations ago, Italian people were made fun of for smelling like garlic.
Exactly.
And their food was considered low class.
Yeah, nutritionists and public health specialists were full of disdain for Italian food as not good for us because they were eating all this spicy food in those days. This was considered, especially garlic. And the argument was that all this garlic led to craving for alcohol. And what I like about American culture is, in fact, the possibility of breaking through it, which I think makes American food very interesting and much more open-minded than many of the nationalist cuisines of other parts of the world.
So when tired, poor, huddled masses of foods arrive on America's shores, we do offer them opportunities they don't get elsewhere. But we don't offer equal opportunity. Coming up, why do some people's foods go mainstream so much faster than others? I'll give you a hint. Some foods just do better on social media. I'll tell you which ones. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. If you're new to this show, please take a quick second and make sure that you subscribe in iTunes or the podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll never miss an episode. Go ahead, just hit subscribe right now while you're listening. You don't even need to hit stop. Great. Thank you. This is episode 2 of our series on food, race, and culture, other people's food. Now, I know I said last week it was going to be a 4-part series, but we just did our live show the other night and there was so much good stuff in it, we can't possibly fit it all into one show. So it's going to be a 5-part series. That means you get 3 more episodes coming this week, including one with civil rights icon Joe McNeil and one with actress Rosie Perez. And we look forward to getting more and more of your feedback as these episodes continue. We've already gotten a ton of response to episode 1, which came out last week. In that show, I talked with celebrity chef Rick Bayless. He's a white guy from Oklahoma who's famous for cooking Mexican food. Now, he's deeply immersed in Mexican food and culture, but he still sometimes gets criticized for his work. And we talked about that.
There have been a number of people out there that have criticized me only because of my race, that because I'm white, I can't do anything with Mexican food. You have to stop and say, wait, is that just plain racism then?
In response, on Twitter, Connie Chung, no, not that Connie Chung, she said, really thoughtful podcast, kind of surprisingly tone-deaf thoughts from Rick Bayless. Sarah Brune tweeted, Rick Bayless says he's never thought about the benefits of being white. Not having to think about it is the definition of privilege. but others defended Bayless. Here's a voicemail I got from a listener named Tony.
I'm a guy from Kansas that's been living in Puerto Escondido, Oaxaca for the past 15 years, and I teach cooking classes here, and I have to agree with Rick that I haven't had any pushback from the local people here. I've actually had pushback from people that are from the United States and white, but not Mexicans.
Last week's show also struck a chord with my esteemed colleague Leonard Lopate, host of The Leonard Lopate Show here at WNYC. He's interviewed Rick Bayless and Julia Child and just about every other famous chef in the country over the years. Here's what Leonard said.
I think there's a kind of reverse snobbery that goes on here, which assumes that only a Mexican knows how to cook Mexican food. When I cook from a cookbook, if I'm cooking French food, if I follow the recipe accurately, I'm cooking a French meal. I'm not translating it. I'm cooking a French meal, and it should come out just as good as it would if I were cooking it in Paris. And Julia Child made that point.
We really love hearing your thoughts on this series as it goes along, so please just keep that feedback coming. Record a voice memo on your cell phone and email it to me, dan@sporkful.com. Now back to today's show and Professor Krishnendu Rey, chair of the NYU Food Studies Department. You know, with every new immigrant cuisine, as it breaks through to mainstream American food culture, there's often one dish that's sort of like the tip of the spear. For sushi, I think of California rolls. For Indian food, chicken tikka masala. For Thai food, pad Thai. I asked Professor Rey what these foods have in common.
Let's say chicken tikka masala, which is, it goes through a series of translations. It becomes sweeter, it becomes redder, it becomes less spicy. Because we have a natural proclivity towards sweeter and fattier things. It's easier to eat them, drink them. That will allow the translation to happen, which is also a form of bastardization or hybridization. And then, maybe after a generation, you will have its redefinition.
Right, and then someone comes along and says, no, I'm going to give you the authentic.
Exactly.
Right.
Now the new wave Indian restaurants are no longer calling the chicken tikka masala chicken tikka masala. They're calling it butter chicken, like I used to eat when I was in Delhi University, in Delhi, in Hindu college. I used to eat butter chicken.
That's what they called
That's the closest thing to chicken tikka masala.
So new food arrives, gets watered down, gets popular, then gets redone to be more, quote unquote, authentic. But Professor Rey says for a culture's food to make it that far today, it needs more than sugar and fat. It needs a good social media strategy. Some dishes just don't work on Instagram.
Lot of third world cuisines, lot of peasant cuisines that taste fantastic does not stand up on a plate. So it does not look very good. You can't make a very pretty picture out of it, which I think also leads to a loss of certain kinds of food. I personally find stews and food that falls flat on its face.
Saucy food,
the most beautiful food, the most tasty food, okay? But those foods don't look very good most of the time in a picture.
The reason they don't look very good actually comes down to the basic rules of photography. Like here, I'll give you an example. Beef stew. Sitting in the pot, the meat and the potatoes and the carrots are all submerged, and all you see is this flat brown liquid. Have you ever tried to take a picture of your beef stew to post online? It is impossible to make it look good, okay? But now I want you to picture something different. Picture a bright white plate. And on that plate, you have a pile of nice, big, juicy chunks of cooked beef. And maybe that takes up a third of the plate. Then you have a pile of carrots, cooked carrots, bright orange. And then the rest of the plate, you have a little mound of potatoes, cooked potatoes. Maybe they still have the skins on them. Then you take that beef broth from the stew and you drizzle it over the food on the plate. That looks good, right? You can picture that. You're getting hungry just picturing that. It's all the same ingredients as the beef stew, but now it's three-dimensional instead of flat. It's colorful instead of monochromatic. That same principle gives chicken tandoori a leg up over dal and blintz is an advantage over borscht. And what Professor Rey is saying is that some cultures' foods have way more dishes like beef stew than others. And that makes a difference.
Media is absolutely central to propagation and popularity of a cuisine and what becomes important. And with the excessive, I think, visualization, the role of the visual in the current media, it constrains what we pick from a cuisine.
The other constraint on what gets picked comes from the food media. Cookbooks, food blogs, TV, newspapers, and yes, podcasts. As much as we hear about the democratization of media, there are still gatekeepers. And some people have to break through more gates than others. Which brings us back to Nicole Taylor, the cookbook author we heard from earlier in the show. She and I were joined by Chitra Agrawal, who writes a food blog called ABCDs of Cooking. ABCD stands for American-Born Confused Desi. Desi is a slang term for a South Asian. Chitra's currently working on her first cookbook.
I wanted to do a book specifically on South Indian home cooking, and I think that the U.S. market in general has not kind of gone to the point where they understand the regional differences of Indian cooking. I mean, when we were trying to sell the book through, it was, oh, well, we already have an Indian author, so we're going to pass on that.
People said that to you?
Well, they said it to my agent.
Right.
And
what do you think when you hear that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't make me feel good because I also feel that it's that you get pigeonholed into a group. Even though my book may have different content and a different perspective and talking about a whole other type of cooking from India, if there's another author that is doing an Indian cookbook, then we just get lumped into the same pile. They probably wouldn't flinch if it was, oh, we have a Southern Italian cookbook coming out and a Northern Italian cookbook coming out.
Right.
Most likely. And I mean, I grew up, I'm a lifelong vegetarian, and I cook food that's not Indian, of course, in my house, but I feel like it will be a hard sell for me to write a general vegetarian cookbook or to sell that through versus selling through an Indian cookbook, even though I'm an American.
What about you, Nicole? What were some of the challenges you faced in trying to get your book published?
So I get the book proposal. We have the book proposal and we send it out. And the first thing people say is, well, is this a soul food book? I felt like at first I was being put into a category and I almost was at the point of like, okay, I'm cool with this. I'm cool with changing my entire book. And then luckily I just kind of stayed in there. And I'm sure my agent probably was like, oh my gosh, here this girl keeps talking about race. But it's true. I mean, people are thinking about that.
So, and let's talk a bit about the way both of your guys' work is marketed. One of the things that I learned in my experience that I think does to some degree dovetail with what you guys are saying, not to suggest that I've had the same experience, but marketing people who are to a point doing their jobs, which is just to try to sell as many of these things as possible, they're always going to try to simplify things and make them feel familiar and similar to other things that consumers can easily recognize. And I get that there are downsides to that. But I think that some of that happens independent of race and ethnicity and culture. Is that fair to say, Chitra?
I would think so. I mean, I feel like I've had a lot of friends who have written cookbooks. Their subject matter may be, you know, less culturally driven, but they still run into that same issue.
And they're very risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they want to buy something that's like 50% the same as something that's sold. Nicole, you seemed a little more skeptical about the idea that when marketers try to simplify some of your work, that it's sort of the necessity of marketing.
I totally agree with what you're saying. I think that the race factor is another layer to them, another line, another something that they're thinking about. The marketing team is sitting there thinking, who's going to buy her book? Is this a black book?
That's Nicole Taylor. She's the author of the Up South cookbook, Chasing Dixie in a Brooklyn Kitchen. It's not a black or a white book. It's just a delicious book. And yes, it does have the fried chicken recipe that Nicole mentioned with the coconut milk. It also has her recipe for chaat masala popcorn. So you can't put this book in a box, people. Just get it. It's called the Up South cookbook. We also heard today from Chitra Agrawal. Her food blog is the ABCDs of cooking. She also has her own line of condiments. She makes artisanal achar.
Achar is basically like an Indian relish. She makes roasted garlic achar, rhubarb ginger achar, and the one that I am currently in love with, tomato achar. It's spicy and salty and sweet and tangy. I've been spreading it on sandwiches, dabbing it on eggs. I mean, you can put it on anything. And they ship nationwide, people. Get some at brooklyndeli.com. That's deli, D-E-L-H-I. Also, we're giving away Nicole's cookbook and some of Chitra's achar. We'll pick winners from the Sporkful email mailing list. You subscribe, I drop you a line once a week, and I'll just tell you what I'm eating, what I'm reading. I think you'll like it. You got to sign up by Friday, April 22nd at noon Eastern. If you're already on the list, you're already entered. For your shot at glory, sign up at sporkful.com/newsletter or text SPORKNEWS to 69866. My thanks as well to Professor Krishnendu Ray, who you heard from in this episode, also heard from him last week. He's the chair of the NYU Food Studies Department. His new book is called The Ethnic Restaurateur. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me, engineering help from Irene Trudell, music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Rebecca Carroll, Arun Venugopal, and Paula Schumann. And to Brenda Williams-Butts, Caledonia Currents, and WNYC's Diversity Council, especially Irva Gunja, Richard Ye, Lee Hill, and Sarah Gonzalez. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Diana Phillips from Kailua, Hawaii, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.